Knowledge Products presents Giants of Philosophy, narrated by Charlton Heston. This is tape number one on Plato.
Almost 2,300 years after Plato died, a 20th century British philosopher, Alfred North Whitehead, paid him a brief but striking tribute.
The safest general characterization of the European philosophical tradition is that it consists of a series of footnotes to Plato.
It's tempting to judge this statement as a friendly exaggeration, but there are good reasons for taking it seriously, perhaps even literally. Plato and no other first asked and brought together in a systematic way the issues and questions that have defined the work of philosophy ever since. It's no overstatement, then, to say that philosophy came into existence with the thought and writing of Plato. In this sense, later philosophers, as Whitehead asserts, carry on the project that Plato first began. To be sure, the generations of philosophers since Plato haven't always agreed with the answers Plato proposed to his own questions. These disagreements continue up to the present day, and they have at times been bitter indeed. So, for example, another 20th century philosopher, Karl Popper, writes these harsh words about Plato's political philosophy.
Plato compromised his integrity with every step he took. He was forced to defend lying, political miracles, tabooistic superstition, the suppression of truth, and ultimately, brutal violence.
It may be hard to imagine that these words describe the same Plato Whitehead praised. Yet so it is. And in one respect, there's no contradiction here. Even Popper would agree that in the history of philosophy, Plato must first be reckoned with, today no less than in the past. As for any great writer, we can read Plato's writings now as if he were indeed our own contemporary. We'll find, in fact, that this is the best way of understanding what Plato was attempting to do in his own time. The tribute Whitehead paid to Plato needs to be taken seriously in a second sense as well. The image conveyed to us through Plato's life and work of what it means to be a philosopher. Plato says it's possible to live, to write, and to teach in a way that raises the questions of philosophy not as logical exercises or theoretical possibilities, but as issues that are alive, practical, and most important of all, unavoidable. For Plato, philosophy originates always in the immediate world of everyday life. It's there, in commonplace experience, that people first become aware of what Plato called the sense of wonder. This wonder marks the beginning of philosophical thinking. And in that beginning, philosophy is nothing if not practical. Like people in many generations before us, we often find ourselves driven to ask about the difference between justice and injustice, or between true knowledge and subjective opinions or beliefs. We ask about the line that separates good from evil, right from wrong. And most generally, we wonder, for ourselves and for other people, about how life ought to be lived, ought to be, what constitutes a full and complete life. These are the questions that set philosophy in motion, not only for philosophers, but for everyone. Just to be capable of reason, the natural capacity that for Plato distinguishes humans from other beings, is to encounter the problems of philosophy. Reason itself wants to know the answers to philosophy's questions. In this sense, philosophy is both natural and inevitable. It's something we can't not do. The only question is whether people will do it well or badly, deliberately or unconsciously, and much of what Plato says has to do with how these alternatives are determined. In its Greek origins, the word philosophy means love of wisdom. Philo, meaning love, Sophia, meaning wisdom. Plato believed the love of wisdom is set in motion whenever human reason encounters the events and objects of the world, as it constantly does. Plato's own life was tied in an unusual way to another life as well, that of Socrates, who was Plato's teacher. Socrates remained a central figure in Plato's thought and writings. Even aside from Plato's testimony, other evidence suggests that Socrates was a remarkable teacher. But in addition to his teaching influence, certain historical events of Socrates' life also impressed themselves urgently on Plato, as they did more generally on the city of Athens, where they both lived. The most important of these events in Socrates' life was its end, the fact and circumstances of his death. Socrates had spent his days as a gadfly, a self-appointed teacher. Walking the streets of Athens, he chose for himself the role of questioner. He asked questions of anyone he met. Questions that reflected his own sense of wonder about politics, about ethics, about education. Socrates himself describes this role.
It is as though Athens were a large, thoroughbred horse, which because of its great size is inclined to be lazy and needs the stimulation of some stinging fly. It seems to me that I have been attached to this city to perform the office of such a fly. And all day long, I never cease to settle here, there, and everywhere, rousing, persuading, reproving.
Since Socrates lived in Athens, the questions he asked applied most immediately to that city-state. How it was governed, what the ethical ideals and practices of its citizens and their leaders were. These questions were often embarrassing and annoying. More often than not, the people he addressed couldn't answer him. And since these people sometimes had power, they eventually decided to take action against Socrates, to stop his questions, not by answering them, but by silencing the questioner. So Socrates, at the age of 70 in 399 BC, was brought to trial on trumped-up charges of corruption and impiety. He was found guilty of the charges and then executed. Athens thus attacked the man who, for Plato and others of his students, had become its main symbol of integrity and wisdom. This attack marked a turning point in Plato's life, with lasting consequences for him. Through Plato's writings, Socrates' death has influenced the history of Western thought. Our acquaintance with Socrates' history has an unusual basis. Socrates had quite consciously decided not to write philosophy, but only to speak it. So Socrates left no written record of his thinking. For Socrates, philosophy had to be always alive, in motion, an active process like speaking itself. And this seemed to conflict with what he saw as the inert, inflexible character of written words. Obviously, since Plato did write, he disagreed with Socrates to some extent on the proper role of the philosopher. But even with this difference, Plato remained close in spirit to Socrates. Everything that Plato wrote, with the exception of a number of letters, took the form of dialogues, conversations which involved the exchange of ideas and sometimes arguments among a number of speakers. In these dialogues, the speaker who is mainly responsible for the direction in which the dialogues go and the conclusions they reach is Socrates. Like Socrates, Plato believes that the truths of philosophy are not the words that appear on a written page, but the spark that the words strike in the mind or soul, inside the person. So Plato writes in one of his letters,
"The principles of philosophy cannot be put in words like other studies. Acquaintance with them must come after a long period of instruction and of close companionship. Then, suddenly, like a blaze kindled by a leaping spark, knowledge is generated in the soul and sustains itself there."
Plato paid homage to his teacher and also wrote in a way that recreated Socrates' oral method. This process has come to be known as the Socratic method. Because Plato's dialogue presents Socrates as their main character, it's almost impossible to distinguish between Socrates' thought and Plato's. Although he's the author of the dialogues, Plato refers to himself in them only twice, and even then he doesn't speak in his own name. When we hear from Socrates in the dialogues, then, it's not clear whether we're listening to Socrates or to Plato, or even perhaps to someone else. We can't even be certain how literally the words are meant. It'd be interesting to have this information, but it doesn't make much difference in understanding the dialogues themselves. In the dialogues, singly and in relation to each other, the central questions of philosophy are formulated in a way that speaks to the audience, much as if the individual reader or listener were part of a conversation. And of course, the dialogues are conversations. The reader, or listener, is meant to participate in the dialogue, to find a place for himself there as a character, not just to read or listen to it. If answers to the questions of philosophy emerge in the dialogues, then they come from the reader or audience as much as from the author. Call this process Socratic, or call it, after its most immediate author, Platonic. In watching the process develop in Plato's dialogues, we gain a full and coherent view of the life and work of philosophy. It's a view that has never been surpassed, and it's rarely been equaled. Plato was born in Athens in 428 B.C. Athens at the time was a city-state in Greek, a polis, with a total population of less than 200,000. But even that number includes a substantial slave population and a considerable number of aliens. The number of citizens was less than 50,000 and was thus small by modern standards. Athens' small size is even more notable considering its unusual achievements, especially in the 5th century B.C. The first half of that century saw notable advances in the development of the arts, in sculpture, architecture, and in literature. This was also a period of innovative developments in legal institutions, political organization, and in the expansion of trade and commerce. By Plato's time, however, the creativity and sense of adventure in this unusual community had worn thin. The Peloponnesian War between Athens and its main rival Sparta had begun 3 years before Plato was born. It continued intermittently for almost 30 years, until 404 B.C., when it ended with Athens' defeat. That defeat provoked a revolution against the democratic government of Athens. Soon, a counter-revolution restored a version of the earlier democracy. This restored democracy was responsible for the execution of Socrates, an event that later influenced Plato's opposition to the democratic form of government. Plato's family was prominent in Athens, and the sense of privilege with which he grew up drew him towards a role in public life. Plato speaks about this in an autobiographical letter.
I cherished, like many another youth, the hope of entering upon a political career as soon as I came of age.
But the social turmoil of the time, and then the execution of Socrates, convinced Plato that he was unlikely to realize his goal of a just and good society by pursuing a career in politics. Something more was required. Plato found this in the study of philosophy, in teaching, and in writing. Only with a basis of that sort, he surmised, would politics have a chance of success. Thus, again in his autobiographical letter, Plato describes his growing conviction that a just society was impossible unless certain difficult conditions were met.
Either those who rightly and genuinely follow philosophy must acquire political authority, or those who have political control must become real philosophers.
Plato was not optimistic about the chances for these alternatives. His own experience with practical politics gave him good reason for doubt. On two different occasions, he accepted invitations from the ruler of Syracuse on the island of Sicily to visit there. He was invited to offer advice on how philosophy might work in actually governing a state. The first visit ended with Plato's imprisonment by an impatient and jealous ruler. The second was followed by the overthrow of the government, which was then replaced by a harsh dictatorship. Plato could reasonably conclude from these mishaps that his energies would be better spent elsewhere, perhaps in teaching the group of students who'd begun to assemble around him. If it was futile, even dangerous, to apply philosophy directly to political institutions, philosophy could at least be embodied in students who might later shape those institutions as leaders. So Plato, returning to Athens from his first visit to Syracuse in about 385 B.C., founded a school. This school later gave its name to many others. Plato called it the Academy, after the grove in which the school was located and which was dedicated to Academos, a Greek hero. Little is known about the actual organization of Plato's Academy, but it's reasonable to suppose that the ideals of education and the curriculum that Plato lays out in his writings were tried out in his own school. We might also guess that the method of instruction there resembled his dialogues, with a give and take, the question and response of the Socratic method. After Plato's death in 348 B.C., the Academy survived under the direction of Plato's students, and then of their students. It continued to exist for almost 900 years, until it was forced to close under a general policy of repression by the Emperor Justinian in 529 A.D. The main source of information that we have about both Plato and Socrates is located in Plato's dialogues themselves. As we've seen, there's an irony in this. Socrates had avoided writing, and Plato shared his reservations about the relation between writing and philosophy. In his dialogue entitled The Phaedrus, Plato offers a striking statement about that relation. We hear Socrates speaking with a quiet emphasis.
You know, Phaedrus, that's the strange thing about writing, which makes it analogous to painting. The painter's works stand before us as though they were alive. But if you question them, they maintain a majestic silence. It is the same with written words. They seem to talk to you as though they were intelligent. But if you ask them anything about what they say, they go on telling you just the same thing forever.
Socrates thus stresses that writing, as soon as it leaves its author's hands, becomes something quite different from the spoken word. Like painting, it gives the appearance of a physical object, but truth and knowledge occur in the mind, which is not material or physical at all. Only direct conversation, where the participants can examine the meaning of what's said, is capable of steering a course to knowledge. To be sure, Plato himself did write. The standard edition of Plato's work includes 28 dialogues. But as dialogues, these writings represent the spoken word. They retain its live quality, and they avoid assertions of doctrine or the bulky appearance of a philosophical system. On the other hand, the dialogue form of writing makes it difficult to determine exactly what philosophical views or theories are actually being proposed. It's not always clear even which views are being attacked or rejected. Nonetheless, certain themes recur in Plato's writings, and we can infer that Plato attaches special importance to them. These can be grouped under several distinct headings, but it's important always to keep in mind that Plato emphasizes the close connections among these and indeed among all philosophical topics. Plato's sometimes been called the great unifier because he emphasized similarities rather than differences, connections rather than divisions, the one rather than the many. So, for example, when Plato considers the problems of political theory, he also refers to the theory of knowledge and the philosophy of art. When he defines the questions of ethics, he shows them to depend on issues of psychology and metaphysics. Nonetheless, it is possible to draw some distinctions among Plato's subject areas, and we'll be focusing here on three different, although related, areas of Plato's thought: his ethical theory, his political philosophy, and finally, a combination of his theory of knowledge and his metaphysics. We turn first, then, to Plato's ethical theory. In Plato's own thought, no more important starting point for understanding ethics could be found than by beginning with the life of Socrates. Here, Plato finds a justification for philosophy and an ethical ideal to which all students of philosophy might aspire. Since Socrates' life serves as an ideal, Plato insists on writing about Socrates himself in the writings which bear most directly on ethics. He does this in a sequence of three dialogues called the Apology, the Crito, and the Phaedo, which describe the trial, the imprisonment, and finally the execution of Socrates. These three dialogues are based on the events at the end of Socrates' life, but they're probably not strict historical records. The statements attributed to Socrates undoubtedly resemble what he actually said. Even if we can't be certain about this, though, we can be certain about the ethical commitment shown in Socrates' trial and death. We can be certain about the connection revealed here between the ethical decisions and the use of reason. Here, too, we find Socrates' famous statement, as compelling as it is brief.
The unexamined life is not worth living.
These words, spoken at a time when Socrates' own life was at stake, demonstrate how powerful the role of reason was for both Socrates and Plato. Not only for theoretical questions, but for the practical question of how one, anyone, ought to live. In the Apology, Plato presents a version of Socrates' speech as he defends himself at his trial. The jury of 500 Athenians, selected by lot, have heard the charges against him. He's accused of corrupting the young people among his followers and of impiety against the Athenian gods. It's evident that behind these charges, perhaps even more important than the charges themselves, there was a sharp personal animosity against a man who had often challenged and embarrassed the leading figures of Athens. Political leaders in the polis had claimed to rule for the good of the people, but in fact they served their own interests. Poets exerted a strong influence on popular beliefs, but they didn't always understand or believe what they themselves said. Rhetoricians and other teachers, known as the sophists, professed to be able to teach anyone to succeed at anything, whether it was worth doing or not. All of these people had been challenged by Socrates, in a relatively small community where anything interesting was soon known by everyone. It's not surprising, then, that an attempt would be made to silence Socrates. When he speaks in his own defense, Socrates attempts first to explain the antagonism that led to his trial. He does this by relating an episode that involves the Oracle of Delphi, a religious figure revered by the Greeks for her wisdom. Chaerephon, a friend of Socrates, had traveled to Delphi to ask the oracle whether she knew anyone wiser than Socrates. The oracle replied that indeed no one was wiser. When this statement was reported to Socrates, he tells the jury, he was puzzled. On the one hand, he didn't consider himself wise. On the other hand, the oracle would not be mistaken. In order to determine what the oracle meant, Socrates began then to talk to other Athenians, to ask them questions about themselves and about their work. In these discussions, Socrates discovered that the people he spoke to, the politicians, the poets, the teachers, were far from being the authorities they were supposed to be. They didn't, in fact, know what they claimed to know. And Socrates concluded that this undoubtedly was the basis for what the oracle had said. Socrates believed he did not possess knowledge or wisdom, and in this respect he was just like many other Athenians. But he was wiser than they were in another respect. Socrates knew that he didn't know, whereas they thought they had knowledge when they did not.
I gave a thorough examination to this person. I need not mention his name. And in conversation with him, I formed the impression that although in many people's opinion, and especially in his own, he appeared to be wise, in fact, he was not. Then, when I began to try to show him that he only thought he was wise and was not really so, my efforts were resented both by him and by many of the other people present. However, I reflected as I walked away, well, I am certainly wiser than this man. It is only too likely that neither of us has any knowledge to boast of. But he thinks that he knows something which he does not know, whereas I am quite conscious of my ignorance.
This profession of ignorance by Socrates has since become known as Socratic irony. In it, ignorance, too, becomes an object of knowledge. But Socrates' irony is more than only a manner of speaking or of showing up his opponents. Ignorance by itself, for Socrates, is not necessarily harmful. Ignorance becomes harmful when a person's not aware that he lacks knowledge. The ignorant person then has no reason to examine himself and to learn. Knowing that one doesn't know is a form of wisdom, and Socrates claims this wisdom for himself. Of course, in repeating this claim at his trial, Socrates could only add insult to injury. It surely didn't help his cause. But the method he uses at his trial is the only one he knows. He speaks the truth and directs it at the people who most need to hear it. Socrates tells the jury,
I am not arguing in my own defense, but rather in yours. Since you will not easily find someone else who, like me, clings to the state as a sort of gadfly.
Nor is Socrates willing to change his opinions or his method because of the possible consequences of what he says. To do this would be to repeat the mistake of not recognizing one's own ignorance.
Even to fear death, my friends, is also to think ourselves wise without really being wise. For it is to think that we know what we do not know.
Socrates' honesty and consistency were not enough to convince his jury. As Socrates himself points out, the vote against him is surprisingly close, 280 to 221. The 501st vote was, by custom, attributed to the goddess Athena, always in favor of acquittal. But the jury's first verdict was not the end of the matter. A second vote was required to determine Socrates' punishment. In ancient Athens, a defendant was permitted to suggest an alternate punishment to the one proposed by his accusers. The jury would then choose between the two. In his case, Socrates' accusers sought the penalty of death. Here Socrates faces a dilemma. If he proposes a real punishment, he would be accepting the jury's verdict. But his view of that verdict is no different from before. He considers himself guilty of nothing more than attempting to educate the people he encountered, of trying to enable them to know themselves. He'd carried on this work, what's more, with no profit to himself. Unlike other teachers, then and now, Socrates didn't accept fees for his instruction. Knowledge is not something he believes that should be bought and sold. In any event, he doesn't think of himself as having knowledge, except for the knowledge that he does not know. So Socrates asks the jury,
what is it that would be proper for me to pay for neglecting
what most people care about. Money-making and housekeeping and military appointments. For trying to persuade each one of you how he could become most good and most wise before he took care of any of his interests. What do I deserve, since I am such as that?
And then he answers his own question.
Something good, gentlemen, if I am to say what it ought to be in truth. And further, something good which would be suitable for me. So, this is my estimate of the just penalty according to what I deserve. Free board in the town hall.
Socrates points out that this was the reward usually given to the winners of prizes at the Olympic Games. It must have been as obvious to Socrates as it is to us now that this proposal would not win over his jurors. For them, it was important that he should admit his guilt. At the very least, they wanted to humiliate him. Even when Socrates, at the urging of his friends, adds that he would be willing to pay a small fine, it's too little and too late. The jury is forced to choose between the punishment of death and the strange combination of punishments proposed by Socrates. Faced with this, the jury sentences Socrates to death. So, even when he confronts the prospect of the death penalty, Socrates doesn't compromise. He once again reminds the jury, after they reach their decision, about his reason for this refusal.
The difficult thing is not to escape death, but to escape wickedness. And now I, being slow and old, have been caught by the slower one. But my accusers, being clever and quick, have been caught by the swifter one. Evil.
He concludes his speech at the trial with a last wish.
One thing only I ask my accusers. Punish my sons, gentlemen, when they grow up. Give them the same pain I gave you. If you think they care for money or anything else, before virtue. And if they have the reputation of being something when they are not, reproach them as I reproach you, that they do not care for what they should.
On that note, the trial of Socrates and the dialogue called the Apology comes to an end. But the account of what happens to Socrates after the trial continues in the second dialogue of the trilogy. The second dialogue is named the Crito, after a friend of Socrates who appears in it. At the opening of the Crito, Socrates is in prison. Crito informs him that a ship, which has been sent on a sacred mission from Athens, is expected to return the next day. While the ship's away, no executions can be carried out. But the news of its return means that time is running out. Crito tells Socrates of a plan. He and other friends have raised enough money to bribe the jailers to allow Socrates to escape. Crito tells him that many cities would welcome him if he were willing to leave Athens. Surely he shouldn't sacrifice his life needlessly. By allowing Athens to carry out the death sentence, Socrates would be contributing to a miscarriage of justice. At the same time, he'd be abandoning his friends and his family. So Crito urges Socrates.
There, Socrates. If you aren't careful, besides your suffering, there will be all this disgrace for you and us to bear. Come, make up your mind. Really, it's too late for that now. You ought to have made it up already. There is no alternative. The whole thing must be carried out this coming night. If we lose any more time, it can't be done. It will be too late. I appeal to you, Socrates. Take my advice and don't be unreasonable.
Crito's words of counsel seem compelling, and there's reason to believe that even Socrates' enemies half expected him to escape. But here, as always, Socrates finds questions to ask, questions which undermine Crito's argument and which, in Socrates' view, Crito is ignored. What's at stake is not only Socrates' life, but certain basic principles. So Socrates reminds Crito.
We must value most, not living, but living well. And we must then first examine whether we shall be doing right in paying money to those who will get me out of this, or whether we shall be doing wrong. We must not, after all, do wrong in return, or do evil to anyone in the world, however we may be treated by them.
Socrates wonders whether justice would be served by his escape. And here his objections to Crito's plan begin to emerge. Crito has failed to consider a crucial question about the relation between the individual and the state. This relation imposes heavy obligations on the citizens, Socrates points out. These obligations are evident in the similarity between the laws of a country and one's parents. By means of the laws, Socrates suggests, people are educated and receive their values. Like a parent, then, the state is responsible for the moral character of its citizens, for the people they become. By escaping from prison, Socrates would be rejecting those laws, much as if he were to attack his own parents because he disagreed with the decision they made. By agreeing to escape, Socrates would be denying more than the verdict. He'd be rebelling against all the laws of Athens, against the authority of the state, and in effect, against the state itself. At the very least, he'd be claiming that the state had no right to judge him. And Socrates' response to this is clear.
Violence is not allowed against mother or father, much less against your country.
Socrates calls to Crito's attention a second and even stronger objection. A man's free to leave his country at any time. If he chooses not to leave, but to remain, he in effect signs a contract with the country to obey its laws. It would be wrong for him to break this agreement just because he sometimes objects to a particular law. This is all the more true if it's not a law he finds fault with, but a person or group of people who misapply the law. Socrates claims that this is indeed what's occurred at his trial. He's been wronged not by the laws, but by human beings. For him to act as if the laws or the state were culpable, then, would itself be an injustice. Socrates imagines what the laws themselves would say if they could speak.
Now, Socrates, what are you proposing to do? Can you deny that by this act which you are contemplating, you intend, so far as you have the power, to destroy us, the laws, and the whole state as well? Do you imagine that a city can continue to exist and not be turned upside down if the legal judgments which are pronounced in it have no force, but are nullified and destroyed by private persons?
With this conclusion, Socrates rejects Crito's proposal. Crito himself concedes that there's nothing more to say. Socrates doesn't claim here that everything a state or country commands a citizen to do is just. He's not even saying that he himself would obey every law or decision adopted by Athens. Socrates had made clear earlier at his trial that if the jury told him he could continue to live in Athens if he changed his way of life, if he stopped his questioning, for example, he would not agree to this. He would go on doing exactly what his conscience told him to. The state, with all its power, couldn't force him to stop doing what he thought was right. But although Socrates might disobey that particular decision or law, he wouldn't even then be rejecting the state as a whole. He'd do what he felt he had to do on the grounds of reason and conscience. The state, on the other hand, would do what it chose to do, and this included executing Socrates. In taking this position, Socrates presents the first known defense of the principle of civil disobedience. A citizen chooses to disobey a law or decree of the government, but he does this publicly and agrees to accept the state's punishment for breaking the law. Civil disobedience forces the state to re-examine its own conscience. It demonstrates to the state how serious the consequences of its policies are. If the government changes its policies as a result of this act, so much the better. Even if it doesn't, the man who commits civil disobedience remains true both to his conscience and to the state. Here too, then, Socrates appears in the role of teacher. On the one hand, he claims the right to disobey a law on the grounds of conscience. On the other hand, he would commit this act of disobedience publicly, with no attempt to conceal it or to avoid the consequences. He accepts the right of the state to judge him for breaking its laws. Having reached this conclusion, Socrates could hardly then attempt to escape the punishment that Athens had set for him. So he awaits that punishment patiently. In making this decision, he recognizes the claims of his own principles and of the laws as well.
This is the end of Side One. Please fast forward and turn over your cassette.